call to order the meeting of the Finance and Administration Committee, of which I am acting chair for the rest of the year, thanks to our chairman's request. May I have a motion to approve the agenda?
So moved.
And a second. All in favor?
Aye.
And a motion to approve the minutes of the prior meeting. All in favor?
Aye.
Today's agenda, which is all information items, no action items, will start off with an update on staff's continued progress in addressing the recommendations from the FDA's Financial Management Oversight Report, including some of the key milestones that are reached in the past month. And obviously, a lot of work is going on. A lot of material has been provided. A lot of improvement is there. I'm hopeful, as I said last month, to begin to raise our sights above that and start setting some view of how we perform our oversight responsibilities for the long run. Not that we haven't done it before, but clear feeling is we haven't done it well enough. So how we establish our basis for doing that so that we not find ourselves back in the place we found before. I'm very comfortable with what we're seeing about progress in response to FMO. I'm looking beyond that to how we continually keep our eye on the ball in terms of the financial condition of the authority. Following that discussion, Dennis Anasicki and his staff will give us an overview of financial performance during the fiscal 2015, including progress on the capital program. And finally, the finance staff will give us a deeper understanding of the principles that are being used, even as we speak, to develop the general manager's proposed 2016 budget, which will be released to us next month. Yeah. Our discussion today continues the FY 2016 budget discussions that the committee held last month and is the framework and will provide the context for more in-depth discussion when the CEO releases his proposed budget, and then we begin to act on it in January, February. Dennis will talk more about this, but while trends show there is an upturn in rail ridership, it still continues to be below where we'd like it to be. There continue to be major ridership impacts from the transit subsidy reduction that has occurred by the reason of Congress not acting to extend the transit benefit. I'll remind you they have a few more months to take that action. Hopefully that will come about, but we can't count on it. But at this point, I would turn the floor over to Mr. Anasicki and his team for the FMO oversight.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I will turn it over to Mr. Fishbein.
Can you pull the mic a little closer?
Thank you, Dennis. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Our objective for this item today is to provide you the monthly progress status on Metro's committed corrective action plan items in response to the Federal Transit Administration's Financial Management Oversight Review Report, including responses Metro's provided to address the recent feedback received from the FTA on some of our 30, 60, and 90-day corrective action plan submissions. At our last update to you on October 9th, we received a committee request for some modifications to the dashboard report for monitoring our progress toward fulfillment of the specified FMO report recommendations. Today, I'd like to confirm these dashboard updates with the committee. First, we have recast the upper left quadrant chart titled FMO CAP Status by Finding to more accurately reflect that only the three material weaknesses and six significant deficiencies are considered findings in the FMO report. And the associated corrective action plans that we committed to address them amount to 54, which matches the total number, 56, which matches the total number of CAPs in the lower right quadrant. The nine CAPs addressing the five advisory comments are tracked separately. The category data in the chart has not changed since last month. However, I will be discussing the two CAPs shown as extended a little later in my presentation. Counterclockwise from there, the FMO-related training in the lower left section provides the numbers of employees who have received training on our new policies and procedures in the areas of procurement, grants management, and asset management. As requested, this chart has been modified to report the number of employees having received training in each of those areas against the total number of employees identified as requiring the respective training. The curriculum development for asset management training is nearing completion, and initial sessions should begin later this month. The lower right quadrant identifies our progress toward fulfilling the FTA's 38 FMO recommendations corresponding to the 9 material weakness and significant deficiency findings. Again, the advisory comments are not included because they're not considered as material or significant findings. So advisory comments aside, we've submitted 54 of 56 corrective action plans that address the 38 FTA recommendations associated with the 9 FMO findings. Since our last review, FTA has confirmed that for the corrective action plans and follow-up responses submitted to date, 7 more recommendations have been adequately satisfied, bringing the total to 21.5, an increase of 18% for a total of 57% of report recommendations satisfied. Please note that both recommendations for significant deficiency 3.1 have been satisfied and are shown highlighted in green. The final quadrant chart in the upper right corner illustrates our progress with respect to the quality and frequency of our grant drawdown submission packages since the restricted drawdown process was imposed in March. The blue bars represent the percentage of a given submission package's total value that was approved for reimbursement without follow-up information needed. As you can see, the rate of submission approvals has improved to a level that is almost consistently at 100%. The tighter grouping of the bars reflects the increased frequencies of our submissions more recently than earlier on. Lastly, the red line tracks the cumulative rate of successful approvals and reimbursements on a total dollars basis. The initial rate was 63% in March. As of October 21st, we've drawn 95% of the total dollars submitted for review, a 1 percentage point increase since my last report. The summary timeline has been updated to reflect key.
Hold that chart for 1 minute. I had a question.
Yes, sir.
Back up. Does the width of the bars have anything with significance?
Only that is 2 submissions on back-to-back dates, and it's the scale of the chart. Anything else? Thank you. The summary timeline has been updated to reflect key milestone activity as of the date of the release of the final FTA FMO report. Since my last update on October 9th, we have submitted responses to FTA follow-up requests for some 30 and 60-day cap items, which we did on October 15th, received follow-up requests for some 90-day cap items, submitted a letter committing to reasonable and realistic dates for the 2 cap extension requests, and yesterday submitted the 2 weeks due responses to the FTA's follow-up requests on our 90-day caps. Our October 15th submission to the FTA fulfilled 5 follow-up requests that we had received. The first included a grants management manual procedures revision to strengthen emphasis on ensuring only compliant indirect costs are reported on our quarterly federal financial reports and drawn down as well. The second was to ensure that the content and delivery of our committed procurement training was closely aligned and fully compliant with the FTA's procurement guidance and regulations per Circular 4220.1F. And lastly, it included 3 updates to our procurement procedures manual on the subjects of timeliness of procurement file completion, inclusion of federal clauses on job order contract task orders, and more detailed guidance on appropriate use of job order contracts as compared to full and open competitive procurements. On October 22nd, we received the FTA's feedback on our 90 days due corrective action plans, in which 7 additional recommendations were deemed adequately satisfied, bringing the total of recommendations satisfied to 21.5. Additionally, there were 9 follow-ups requested involving providing additional documentation and further evidence of testing or records reviews for 2 significant deficiency findings, which were controls over FTA-funded assets and access controls over the financial management system. Yesterday, we submitted the responses to the October 22nd follow-up requests regarding federally funded assets that included a revision to our asset management manual regarding use of rolling stock asset reports for federally funded assets disposals, proper accounting for asset disposal proceeds, and proper documentation supporting financial system records. Additionally, follow-up documentation was provided for a formal process for granting, reviewing, and removing access to PeopleSoft, its supporting database, operating system infrastructure, and data center. Also, evidential documentation of a formal review of all PeopleSoft accounts and data center access, procedures relating to PeopleSoft password settings and requirements, and lastly, evidence of proper segregation of duties for database administrators and developers. As requested back on October 1st by the FTA, on October 30th, we submitted, it should be the 30th, I'm sorry for that, we submitted a letter committing to reasonable and realistic dates for our schedule to complete the two grants budget controls, material weakness, corrective action plans, and confirming procedural adherence to proper and timely resolution of all identified incorrect grant draws. I would like to conclude by reviewing our next steps. First and foremost is to ensure we achieve all of our milestone obligations to FDA and the regional office on our extended caps as we've committed. We're continuing with all activities necessary to resolve all open grants issues and correctly draw against them. We will kick off our latest newly developed FMO-related training program for asset management procedures. And we'll ramp up our internal compliance review activities for ensuring conformity with all applicable federal regulations, guidelines, and financial management controls. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions from the committee. Thank you for your time.
Other questions? Mr. Ewell.
Well, not a question, just a statement. Certainly, we've had a lot on our plate. We all have. But pleased to see that progress is being made, and this is certainly, you know, really good news, and hopefully we can put this behind us.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'll share that. Other questions? I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Downey.
We have so many people around this table.
We're almost at full strength. There were 16 pictures out there today when I walked in. It's kind of stunning. So thank you for your work. This is all very good progress, as Mr. Ewell said. I continue to think about when we get through this part of the work that we're doing, that we're going to be in a situation where monitoring on these dimensions, for the board monitoring on these dimensions, is going to be a critical piece of what this committee has to do. And so I raise this only in the sense of, I know you guys are swamped doing this, but I think we need to be thinking about what are those key things that we're going to want quarterly or twice a year or annually to see, so that we have confidence moving forward. And it's in the context of all the work we've done around safety, where we've taken the time to do this right and build a consensus and build a community understanding as we move into more challenging financing for Momentum. It's going to be really critical that everybody understand what the board is keeping its eyes on, and that we have the region's back, if you will, in this whole endeavor. So not for this month or next month, but we really, I think by the time we adopt that budget for 16, we need to have our arms around what's the board going to see on a regular basis, what's going to be available to the community, so that we know that this is well in hand, in the same way that we know that about the safety of the railroad. So sort of looking ahead.
Yeah, mine is really a process question around building capacity. And I think for every challenge that we experience individually or as an organization, it's an opportunity. So that's the frame of my question. So I know that we put a lot of effort in implementing PeopleSoft. And my question is, are we using this work to fully deploy our capability with PeopleSoft and grants management and assets management, so that we are institutionalizing and getting, you know, the robust result that an enterprise system would provide? And I know sometimes it's hard to think about that when you're in the middle of just trying to get the work turned around, but I think that's an important consideration.
Yes. As you know, much of the issues regarding the grants findings in the FMO report were about some open grants, 35 open grants, and of which 18, 17 have been closed, 18 are still open. A lot of them involve matching up available eligible expenses with the proper grant budgets and doing a lot of budget line item reconciliations, changes, amendments to the grants. So we are dealing still with a lot of historical data, and a lot of that historical data was fresh from the cutover when we did the re-implementation of PeopleSoft. But I believe that once we are completed with all of these cleanup activities going forward, we'll be able to be utilizing the system as effectively and efficiently as we designed it to and intended to coming out of the IFO project. Of course, along the way, any changes that we can make and any modernizations or updates that we find be beneficial and allow our processes to be better controlled and give us, you know, better reporting, ensure that any kind of mistakes or errors are caught before, you know, flowing through the whole financial processes, we'll be taking advantage of those in the future. So certainly that is our intent to do that along the way and going forward.
Just to add to that, PeopleSoft, IT people tell me, you know, works fine. It's the business practices that lead to what goes into it, and the people. Yes. The people do the business practice. So it's improving, as we go along here, we're improving the business practices and also addressing the human part of it.
Anyone else? I just would like to add my thoughts to Ms. Hines and Hampshire Collin. We have gone through a time when we have strengthened our systems, strengthened our people, strengthened our focus. We need to figure out how we use that new capability to do your jobs better and do our jobs better. We look forward to working with you on what that cycle would look like. What are the indicators and the targets that would tell us, for example, that receivables had gone beyond some level? I think we'll now have that capability. It would be an error for us not to use it well. Two quick questions. On some of the responses to FTA involves changes to the procurement manual or other manuals. I assume there is not full retraining, but at least assurance that everyone who has been trained is now aware of those changes.
Yes, as we continue and go through the new rounds of training, yeah, and subsequent rounds and retraining, we'll make sure that any of the significant changes, yeah, certainly are in there. A lot of the changes have been just more minor nature, maybe strengthening some language, right, and just getting the FTA a little more comfortable that we're thoroughly
committed that that's what we're going to be doing.
But yes,
got to be sure everybody has the word. And the other question I have is, any response yet from FTA on the rescheduling request?
No, not yet.
Not yet. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, item 3B is the FY15 first quarter budget review. I will be providing this review, and Rodrigo will provide the capital review after the operating budget review. Overall, total ridership for July through September was almost 1 million trips higher than the same period in FY14. This includes almost 500 trips on Metro Rail and 400 trips on Metro Bus. There were no notable weather events or anomalies during this period, so this is truly an apples-to-apples comparison that represents real change and real growth with respect to ridership. Part of the growth on Metro Rail, of course, is due to the new Silver Line. Civil line service kicked off successfully at the end of July and wrapped up in August. As you heard from Lynn earlier today, we have seen so far positive growth along the new stations, along with the station-to-station interplay that's consistent with a system of this size. But compared to FY15 budget, year-to-date ridership is below budget. Most of the negative variance is on Metro Rail, which is down 2.7 million rides for the year. With respect to Metro Bus, there was a slight variance, a negative variance again, in this case about 900,000 rides, with most of that variance occurring in August. However, ridership on Metro Access is up 30,000 trips, which takes the total ridership for Metro Access to 570,000 trips for the quarter. From a revenue perspective, systems revenue closely tracked ridership. Total passenger and parking revenues for the quarter was $212 million, an increase of approximately $10 million over the same period last year. Overall, Metro generated $233.4 million revenues for the period, which is $9.2 million unfavorable to budget. In terms of modes, Metro Rail and Metro Bus revenues were below budget by 4 and 2% respectively, again tracking the ridership that we saw on the system. On the other hand, Metro Access revenues were above budget, again tied to elevated ridership for the period. But moving on to expenses, year-to-date expenses were $438 million, which is $5.9 million positive to budget. And as a result, Metro had a 53% cost recovery for the quarter. Overall, personal expenses were on par with budget, while non-expenses were favorable to budget, primarily due to savings, as you saw last month and as we discussed earlier in the year, from fuel, utilities, and services. And I should indicate at this point that actions taken earlier in the year to address expected softening in terms of ridership, among other things, have contributed to the cost structure that we saw. I should also point out that the year-to-date expenses that we are reporting today include some capital costs that are temporarily housed in the operating budget, pending resolution of procurement questions with the FTA. To the extent that those issues are resolved successfully, those costs will be shifted back to the capital budget, thereby reducing operating costs. Mr. Chairman, unless there are questions, I will turn it over to Rodrigo at this point to speak about the capital program.
Are there questions regarding the operating budget presentation? Ms. Goldman.
A couple questions on the operating in the first quarter that you just related to. In your statement, you indicated that one of the prime movers for the reduction in rail ridership was the transit benefit failure of Congress to renew that. But in the discussion papers, you also identified a number of other factors. Perhaps you could identify those other factors and give the board some sense as to what weight you put on the transit benefit reduction as opposed to the other factors that you cited in your background paper.
Thank you, Mr. Goodman. As was discussed last month with respect to ridership, I believe my colleague described a series of factors that impact ridership on an ongoing basis. And one of the factors that we identified at that point, and which was part of the message that was put out, is the fact that the discrepancy with respect to transit benefits is a factor, particularly with customers who rely
on rail more frequently than they rely on bus. And the preliminary analysis that has been conducted, at least with respect to our customers, indicates that that is one key factor that has impacted their behavior so far. That said, obviously, there's, as was discussed last time, there's shifts in employment levels. There's shifts, obviously, with the use of alternative transportation modes. All of those come into play in terms of ridership. But with respect to rail and the significant reduction, or rather, the reductions that we're seeing in terms of its usage, we believe that the transit benefits reimbursement guidelines have a significant impact on that.
But has your analysis gone to the point where you can identify a percentage and attach it to the transit benefit reduction as opposed to sequestration, as opposed to changes in the broader economy, as opposed to telecommuting?
No. We have not gotten to that level of granularity, but as we get more information, obviously we'll make that available to you. But at this point, we believe that that is a contributing factor to what we're seeing on rail.
Just shifting subjects, the other question I had is that you referenced the $45 million reduction in expenses that the general manager had announced a few months ago for all of FY, 2015, what we're in now. And then you showed us some numbers for the first quarter. Did the first quarter reflect one quarter of those expense reductions, or do you expect the expense reductions to be more backloaded through the other three quarters of the fiscal year?
Actually, we believe that it is embedded in those numbers. While you are seeing a first quarter net performance of a negative $3 million, if and when we resolve the issues with respect to the capital charges, that will really translate to the numbers that we expect as a result of the reductions that the GM imposed at the beginning of the year.
So what you're saying is that while the first quarter doesn't reflect that one quarter, you would expect that when there's an adjustment between operating costs and capital costs, it may come closer to that.
It will come close to that, and obviously we did not want to be presumptuous in including those numbers because this is still an active conversation, but we believe that once that conversation is concluded that the numbers will be reflective of the initial budget expectations.
Okay. And finally, in overtime, I think there were some indication that the overtime numbers are still fairly high. I don't have those numbers before me, but I just wanted to ask if you could comment on that, because I know there were some proposals to reduce overtime and bring that in line going forward for all of FY15. Could you give us some insight into how those efforts are going?
With respect to overtime, the trend is positive, which means that both in terms of overall hours of overtime and overall expenses, they're actually down compared to same time last year, which again speaks to the efforts that the team made in terms of quote-unquote right-sizing the budget. Unfortunately, still slightly higher, but I don't want to understate the efforts that operations and the organization as a whole has taken in order to manage overtime in addition to the levels contained in the budget. So when you compare this FY15 to FY14, at least for the first 3 months of the fiscal years, overtime expense is less, overtime hours is less, but with respect to the budget, it's, I believe, about $2 million higher.
I mean, the specific question I have is that the $45 million included, I guess, identified $4 million in annual overtime savings. And my question is, are you on track, do you believe, to meet that additional $4 million reduction in overtime expenses?
Again, I mean, this is 3 months. My expectation is that while we are seeing this temporary blimp in overtime in the first quarter, what it complements to that is the reduction in terms of the reduction in personal expenses that we expect that we're seeing and expect to continue to see. So by the end of the year, we are confident at this time that we will see that savings that was embedded in the original reductions.
Other questions? On the issue, oh, yeah, I'll call you in a second. And the issue of the transit benefit, which is obviously key to our ridership, I'd just like to ask Mr. Bulger if he has anything to offer on what's being done to bring that change about with the Congress.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And what we could do to help.
As of a little while ago, there was 61 business groups, government groups, trade associations, including the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, have signed a letter that's going to go to Congress today, to the Senate, and to the House, targeting the House Ways and Means Committee. The letter from the coalition will state, and I think I sent it to the whole board weeks and weeks ago, I see nods, that the transit benefit is 88% less than the parking benefit. Parking benefit's $250 a month. The transit benefit right now is $130 a month. It asks Congress to, in the lame duck session that we're going to start next week, to make the transit benefit permanent with the COLA going forward, based on the Joint Tax Committee's score that I got back in this late summer from meetings that we held in June, which says that the parity number for both benefits is at $235 a month with the COLA made permanent going forward, and then that the benefit at $235 a month for 2015 would also generate $131 million, de minimis as it sounds, over 10 years to the good for the Treasury. So of the 55 tax extenders that are pending this lame duck session of Congress, the transit benefit as we've got it positioned right now for consideration in the lame duck is a positive parity number, $235 a month. I'll finish, Mr. Chairman, by saying we were having a press conference on next Wednesday on Capitol Hill with our sponsors and organizers of the fly-in that we're having on Capitol Hill with meetings all day on Wednesday and some on Thursday to try to move the issue. A press release will go out today to national media announcing this. Another press release will go out from the sponsors of the legislation probably on Friday or Monday announcing the press conference and the participants who are going to be coming in from all over the country to meet with members of Congress and their staff. So that's where we are. We hope we can move the needle. And as the Ways and Means Committee staff has told me, which is like getting a root canal, some people of the 55 tax extenders, some people are going to get off the island, and some people are not going to get off the island. So that's the island joke.
And is there anything we should be doing to help this cause?
Well, you know, we got a lot of retiring members of Congress that have constituents that are adversely affected by the drop to $130 a month. You know, I was talking to VRE the other day. They're, you know, on... they're really affected by this, particularly their congressman, Mr. Whitman. And you know, Frank Wolf's not been engaged. You know, there's other suburban members of Congress on the Republican side have not been engaged at all. Our chief Republican sponsor is Mr. Peter King, who represents the Long Island Railroad constituency. Many of you worked in the Northeast. Their fares on the Long Island Railroad are way over $130 a month. You know, anybody who wants to weigh in, we would appreciate the help to move this. As the Ways and Means staff has told me on numerous occasions, someone has to bring this up. And this is going to be inside baseball in a lame duck session of Congress. It's not going to be a hearing. It's not going to be open session. This is going to be, you know, a leadership call, and someone who has constituents who are paying way more to get to work. You know, this is a working class issue. This is not a corporate tax issue. This is not the R&D credit, the solar credit, the wind credit, the whatever. This is a working class, getting people to work issue. So, yeah, please weigh in.
Thank you. Ms. Hutchins.
I really think, and I think we've done this before, and I think we should continue as a follow-on to that, that from the local jurisdictions, we really need to be in the front of that, too. We probably are repeating ourselves, but I think it's good to repeat ourselves, mm-hmm. as well as to engage our riders. I think we really need to engage our riders to do this. I listen to folks who send me here. Therefore, they need to listen to the folks that send them me.
I'll give you the website. It's a long one. It's called Commuter Benefits Work For Us. And on the website, commuterbenefitsworkforus.com, there's a standard letter. It's targeted to long-distance commuters, mid-distance commuters, to write letters to their members of Congress. Again, commuterbenefitsworkforus.com.
Has the authority signed up in support of the increase on the transit benefit?
I don't have WMATA's name on the letter. Can I get that approval today?
Is it ready today? Okay.
What's the news?
Okay. There is a letter, apparently.
And what does the letter say?
I haven't seen the letter.
Okay, Mr. Chairman.
Check is in the mail.
Your check is in the mail. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, great conversation. I was just reminded when I looked at my email that the Council of Governments meets this week as well, or next Wednesday, I guess, and we may want to request a letter there, and I will. We can work through that a little bit with some of us who have those connections and make sure that perhaps that can get added to the agenda, because that really is a multi-jurisdictional, bipartisan group will perhaps help a little. I did want to ask another question, Mr. Yes. Chairman, if I might. And Mr. Anasiki, you gave a little bit of information about what's going on with Metro Access. And I think all of us remember when Metro Access was kind of growing like Topsy, the costs were. And we had conversation last year about trying to work through COG to get to some of the social services providers, not asking for an update today, but I think it's really important for us to get an update on where we are with that. And it really, I think there is a reframing of these costs that needs to be done, as a jurisdiction that takes a lot of that on our side because we offer an alternative service. The actual dollars are not of great impact to Arlington. But as a region, I think we just have to figure this out better and not have this be driving a lot of our conversation. I would ask for maybe it's customer service, maybe it's finance that it needs to come back to, but it needs to
come back. As I recall from last year, we asked to kick off a regional study that we would be a cooperator in, and we should get a follow-up
right,
on how that's
like
going.
And I just would like to know whether anything's happening or whether we're stuck and we need to put some pressure in some other places.
Mr. Downs?
I want to recognize that the staff has worked very hard with the district about establishing a dialysis-based transportation network. It's taxicab-based with accessible vehicles that will absorb 200,000 trips a year and encourage everybody that there is a probable model here for the region, for jurisdictions to establish this type of service that is, in effect, the same quality of service at a lower level cost per trip. And that's to everybody's advantage, and the district would be glad to host anybody who would like to get a in-depth explanation of how this is working. It's one of the few things that we've been able to develop that has been actually able to divert demand off of our regular access service.
Let me echo that offer from Arlington, too. If people are interested in learning more about what we're doing, we're happy to share.
Great. Did you have a question?
I just want to respond to Mr. Downs' comment because I think it would be good to get a report from Mr. Kent because I think there has been that communication with that group, and I know that they are working with the DC piece in terms of that, so it's a broader use of that.
And I was just going to also note that the Transportation Planning Board has also been very active in working with the districts and channeling money to help this get started. And the district has sort of been the bellwether and the pilot in terms of getting this going. And I think the advantage of this service is it's not only a lower cost way of providing Metro Access rides, but it's also available to people who are not Metro Access eligible, who are paying on their own and paying essentially for a cab ride, but it makes it easier for them to get around. So it's sort of a win-win-win process, and I think spreading it to other jurisdictions is nothing but good news for everybody.
I would also add that your request for the MTA report on
yes.
The 11 jurisdiction
Mike.
Yes. Service against several criteria, cost per trip, ridership, catchment zone, et cetera. If you've not had a chance to take a look at the comparative data, I think there's a lot to be learned there, and maybe there are lessons from other jurisdictions that actually have lower cost per rider and better fleet utilization, seemingly from the numbers they're reporting. But I'd encourage you to take a look at it. It's an interesting first time ever that I've seen comparison of access services provided by 11 regions around the country.
And the report was in the diligent package this week. Mr. Bitar, how are we doing on capital?
Doing good. Good morning.
Morning.
Today we're going to be presenting the first quarter for fiscal year 15 of this capital program. The total expenditure for fiscal year 15 is $81 million through the month of September. For reasons like Dennis already explained, we have transactions that haven't been transferred to the capital project, so obviously the number looks low for the end of the first quarter. That does not mean that the work has stopped out there. As the finance transactions take place, the number is going to start increasing and changing. The other thing that you don't see in this graph is the forecast. And it's not there because we're just at the point right now to finalize the forecast with different project managers. My office, along with the CFO office or MBS office, we have been meeting with all the program managers to make sure that the forecasts are accurate. After 14 was closed and the rollovers were determined and everything was set, we started meeting with them to determine the actual forecast. So we didn't want to project something that was inaccurate at this point in time, but for the next presentation, we will have it over there as we normally do. This capital investment program summary shows 9 subgroups and their individual expenditures to date. In the third and fourth columns in the middle of the slide, you will see that $81 million expended through September 30th represents 7% of our total capital budget. In the following slides, we will review relevant projects for some of these 9 subgroups. So looking at vehicles and vehicle parts, Metro continues to make progress with all 3 projects tracking according to schedule. This group has spent 12% of its budget. Bus rehabilitations continues to move forward with a total of 8 completed rehabilitations to date and 12 in progress. We have received 33 new buses and expect the delivery of the Metro Access vehicles during the third and fourth quarter of the year, just like last year. Those vehicles tend to be delivered at the end of the fiscal year, towards the end, third and fourth quarter. Turning to track and structures, let me report that all areas in this group are moving forward. we have invested over 20% of this program's capital budget. Regarding the floating slab rehabilitation, like in years past, there is a lot of preparation work that needs to take place during the first two quarters of the year, and then we will see progress towards the third and fourth quarter of the year, pretty much like last year. In contrast, we have made significant progress in other areas. If I can draw your attention to cross ties, miles of track tamped, switch replacements, and running rail replacement, all of these areas are ahead of their schedules. Maintenance and other facilities groups, starting with CIP 85, Post Garage, WMATA issued notice to proceed to the contractor in February 2014. The contractor mobilized the site to the site and commenced site preparations activities. The project scheduled completion date is September 2015. Capital Project 84, Southern, Post Garage. As mentioned in my last presentation, the notice to proceed was given this past September to Hensel Feltz. The contractor started to mobilize personnel, and we have a scheduled completion date of July 2017. Next, Capital Project 71, the test track, parking garage, and commissioning facility. The commissioning facility and parking garage are scheduled to be turned over to WMATA the week after Thanksgiving. Furniture has been ordered, and it is scheduled to be delivered during the second week of December. Regarding the test track, as you may recall, I reported that the construction of the test track depends upon CSX supply and flagging support, since we are constructing the test track adjacent to their track. 3 weeks ago, CSX announced to us that they will need to take away one of the two people that they assigned to our project. We're currently working with Skanska to assess the project impact and establish a new schedule. Regarding capital projects 101 and 102, both locations continue to be on a schedule, and we expect to take over in December, next month. In terms of NTSB requirements, I'm happy to report that both capital projects are progressing according to schedule. As shown in the chart, expenses are a little bit ahead of the deliverables. This is due to material ordered but not yet received, and material on hand is being installed by WMATA workforces. So we need to pay those salaries. Regarding CIP 139-P6, power cable replacement. To increase production levels, we augment the installation crews using Trulen as contractor. As you know, a couple months ago, they went bankrupt. Since then, the program and procurement offices have been working with the bonding company and were able to resolve the issues and got this part of the project restarted. We're expecting to meet the target of replacing 20,000 linear feet this fiscal year. CIP 139-06, the track circuit replacement, our supplier is in saldo and is maintaining the production schedules. Our first track shutdown is scheduled for November the 21st through the 23rd. That's the first one. And we're expecting to install 25 modules and 30 bonds. So we're on track on this one. That's why we don't have any actuals listed over there, because the first shutdown is just coming up. Lastly, vertical transportation. Elevators and escalators continue to move forward in all three categories. CIP 72, which is elevator rehabilitations. We have a target of 15 elevators this year. At the end of September, there were two completed and five were in progress. Escalator rehabilitations, we have a target of 29 this year. At the end of September, we have six completed and eight were in progress. And lastly, CIP 185, which is the escalator replacement, we have a target of 12 for this year. Two have been completed and six locations are in progress. And with that, that concludes my presentation. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Jacob and then Mr. Downs.
Thank you for your report. I'm looking at page 29 of 69, which shows the overall monthly investment performance. And a whole series of questions come up, mostly because of understanding what information you're taking from the sub-reports. In other words, each project you have, I'm assuming you have a profile on each project which shows outlays over various quarters or years. Clearly, some of these projects take several years. So the first question I have relates to this chart, and is this reflecting the page 29 of 69 of the book, which is the monthly investment? Yeah, it's the next one, I think. Keep going.
Back up.
Or back up. Yeah, that one right there. When you said you're doing well, I can't judge by that chart that you're doing well. One is that, what's the trend? How did we do in the previous 2 years? You know, for instance, to give some comparison. But also, does this reflect ongoing projects from the previous fiscal years and the outlays associated with that, or is this just new starts? That's one question. Go ahead.
Okay. First, it's a combination of both. New projects coming online, other projects that are continuing. Compared to other years, we're a little bit behind. But we need to keep in mind that the mix in the behavior of the program itself depends on the individual projects. So, like in years past, the Red Line program was a huge program and it was moving and that generated a lot of expenditures. Then we moved to the, at one point in time we had red and blue and orange and that generated a lot of expenditures. Now we only have blue and orange, and depending on what stage or phase in that particular one, the expenditure rate will vary. That's why we changed a couple months, 6 months ago, probably 9 months ago, we changed from comparing last year to this year to compare actual expenditures versus the forecast that we have, because the years behave differently. I don't know if that quite answered your question, but that's the gist of it.
Well, yes and no. The question is, we'd like to see the trends of previous years. It seems like you're starting slow.
Yes.
Particularly when you consider the fact we're spending money from the previous year's projects as well. And I think the angle should be a lot steeper than it is, but that's my perception. From my own personal point of view, and I don't think the rest of the board may be interested in this, I'd like to see your master listing of all the projects and how you come up with these numbers. But that being said, trends would be helpful. And so basically that's my question. You know, it just seems to me we're starting slow, and I'm a little concerned because if you look at the budget, it's $1.1 billion.
Yes.
Yet you only show it to $900 million here. So, I mean, you know, those are the kinds of things I look at.
We'll provide that
to Mr.
Giancola. Anyone else? Mr. Downs, and then Ms. Porter.
I want to go back to the test track, and could you tell me again what's happening with CSX? I didn't fully understand it.
Sure. We had a meeting. CSX called a meeting with us about 3 weeks ago, and they told us basically that they're falling behind in their own projects. In their own programs, that they need the resources. Therefore, they're taking one of them to be utilized on their projects, whatever that is. And they said that we will keep one, but not the second one.
What's the projected impact of CSX's dithering?
Yeah, not just on the test track, right, but also on our ability to test.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm after.
Yes.
This is the ability to incorporate our new cars into the system in a timely fashion. We had a completion date of this scheduled for early this year, if I remember, or late last year. Are we into some indeterminate future here about the completion of the test track?
If I could, to answer the first question in regards to the impact to testing the cars, I think is probably the most important thing.
you know, when we look at what the impact is for the completion of the test track. We will continue to test the cars on schedule. You know, we've obligated to Kawasaki that we will do that. We will continue to test the cars on schedule. And what we do, we utilize our existing track, as we've done with the, you know, first six series of cars that, the you know, we received. So, you know, again, that is an impact our non-revenue new periods. You know, we're shifting some work elements around where we're doing some other work. So we're shifting schedules around where we may have planned to do, you know, ties or fasteners in a certain area. We're shifting that work to another area and then coming back and addressing that. So first and foremost, it will not impact the delivery schedule for Kawasaki. We've committed to Kawasaki that we'll be able to test those cars, you know, on that period of schedule. What Mr. Bitar is doing is, you know, working with CSX. I do want to preface this with saying we were way out in front of this with CSX. We were 2 years ahead on this test track. We've coordinated with them significantly on this. This was not a failure on anybody's part, you know, with the WMATA not to give CSX the scheduling that we would be in doing this. Additionally, we are paying for these watchmen and their services, so that's not an issue. So what they did is they pulled this watchman off. Essentially what it does is it reduces the amount of work area that we can work in, because, you know, it's only the one watchman instead of the two, so the adjacency where we can work. So what he's done is he's going back to the team and said, how can we do this work faster and better? So what we have looked at is things like utilizing, you know, we recently got a stone train, you know, of our own, so that we can work on the adjacent track and be able to, you know, pull in and out to be able to work the stone train. We're working to be able to, you know, widen, and we thank the board and our passengers. You know, we talked about single tracking events, you know, during the day. We're utilizing single tracking events during the day, which we hadn't planned on doing before. So we're trying to maximize those amounts of times that we're doing that. So yes, there is an impact. It's not indeterminate. Right now, we're looking at
probably 2 months.
Two months or so to complete on this. But again, As CSX has, you know, not worked with us, you know, the team has been very responsive in saying, okay, these are where we're going to get efficiencies.
This is not costless. At peak delivery, we're getting how many cars per month?
16.
Sixteen cars per month.
Which is 4 Meritor. Four so heavy.
As you point out, there are other work disruptions that are necessary to accommodate this acceptance testing on regular service routes. It's easy to say, this has, we will keep testing without listing what that entails for the rest of the system. This makes me really nervous about acceptance track. I would like a better report about the impact and the expected turn-on time for the test track.
Yeah, certainly.
If we could.
Certainly, no problem. Yeah, no problem.
And I will say we are not alone in terms of CSX.
Oh, no, I know.
Ask Governor Cuomo about the day that the Tappan Zee Bridge shut down because the CSX couldn't deliver a flagman.
Right, I know.
We've all been through this
with CSX.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
What Tom's sort of asking for, I guess, sitting here as the person who knows nothing about how any of this stuff gets built, the thought occurs to me that maybe the cheapest thing is for us to pay for a watchman.
We can't pay
for another one?
No. Oh, absolutely. It's not a question of payment. We would pay for 4 watchmen if that was the case. It's simply that they feel that they don't have the capacity, that they need to do their own projects. So they just essentially pulled them off, and they said, you know, so it's not a question of payment. It's not a question of payment. It's simply a question that they do not have the watchman to be able to provide us is what they is what they have given us. Again, we have
the safety issue. It's not a watchman, you know, worrying about a car if somebody coming through the on the property. This is a safety issue for them in terms of protecting their track against our adjacent operation.
It's maintenance of way, and it's CSX's at times inability to manage their maintenance of way workforce. The labor contracts with Class I railroads mean that all of the maintenance of way control has to be done by their maintenance of way labor with that railroad. So you can't just hire an additional flagman for the project, but the idea that they'll get to us when they get to us because they're busy is not the right answer.
May I ask just a clarity of the message that we have out here? What is our first delivery for the next year that we have planned, and will it occur? That is,
the rail cars.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes.
We're expected to start receiving cars late December. Another quad, four cars, either late December or first week of January. Mm-hmm. Right now we're testing out of the red line. Mm-hmm. I just want to make a point that we have been trying to work within our system, and that's why I pointed out how far ahead we are on the tracking structures work, because we're getting that ahead. All that work needs to be done to minimize the impact on the regular maintenance that we have to do. It's not like we have not been paying attention to it. But when they walk in a room and just drop the bomb that we're going to be cutting support in half, everybody needs to start working on how can we react to this. So we're looking for efficiencies. We're looking for new equipment, new technologies, different options of how we can reduce the impact. There will be an impact. I just don't know the impact at this point in time. Pretty sure in the next couple of weeks we'll be in a position to.
Okay.
We need to move to the budget discussion, yeah. But if you will give us a report on the
test track issues, we'd appreciate it.
I find, and let's use this one that's up on the screen there. I find this way of presenting information very useful. But when I was looking it over ahead of time, I was very surprised to see the status in every single case is green. Now, you've talked about how some things, like for 0% complete status, you know, on schedule, you've explained that that can be things in process. But during your presentation, you talked about a couple of cases where we are redoing the schedule. And I guess I don't understand why, if we're redoing the schedule, how can we possibly know that something is on schedule? And I would appreciate it if we had a more helpful way of designating status than just designating everything green unless we know for sure we're behind schedule.
Yes, your point is taken. The premise of this is if we're going to be able to complete it within the fiscal year, continues to be green, but your point is taken that it could be 3 months behind schedule within the fiscal year. The waste percentage still shows as green. So
it would be more helpful if we had something other than just everything being green. It would be helpful in terms of getting that kind of information out to us, which I assume is what the purpose of that graphic is.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, agenda item 3C is a preview of the FY16 budget. And as you heard from the general manager and the deputy general manager of operations last month, the FY16 operating and capital budgets that the general manager will propose for board consideration in December will be guided by the same principles and key business activities that underlie Metro's momentum strategy. That said, FY16 will be a challenging year with constrained resources for system maintenance and for delivering quality transit services to Metro customers. Despite this challenge, however, the FY16 budget investments will again focus on advancing key programs and enhance system safety to improve the customer experience of Metro. The budget will also increase focus in two areas. fatigue risk management, and internal compliance, two initiatives that will be designed to improve organizational safety and financial management. The GM's FY16 budget proposal will seek to accomplish these goals without increasing fares and while holding the line in the growth of regional operating support at a reasonable level. To do this, Metro will focus on identifying additional opportunities to streamline operations and to balance Metro's budget and meet its obligation to the region and its customers. As with the FY15 budget, the strategic priorities that will serve as the springboard for the GM's FY16 budget proposal are building and maintaining a premier safety culture and system, meeting and exceeding customer expectations by consistently delivering quality service, ensuring financial stability by investing in Metro's people and assets, and last but certainly not least, improving regional mobility and connecting communities. For each of these goals, the budget will build on current initiatives and look for ways to expand on prior Metro investments. For example, safety continues to be Metro's number one priority, both for customers and for employees. Improving safety will include strengthening the safety culture for employees and customers and reducing injuries. We will continue to work on closing remaining NTSB recommendations, but the full implementation of the automatic train operations by the end of 2017 will also lay the groundwork for safer and smoother rail travel. Moving on to on-time, reliable Metro Rail, Metro Bus, and Metro Access services, the budget will seek to strengthen service quality and reliability by maintaining vehicle availability through ongoing vehicle maintenance programs. We'll also continue to invest in new cars and new buses. As you heard last month, the new rail cars and the new buses that we are investing in will travel more miles before creating a single minute of delay for customers. And by partnering with jurisdictions to make bus stops throughout the region accessible for riders, and by maintaining, and in some cases, expanding Metro's escalator and elevator maintenance program, which Rico just described, the budget will ensure more reliable service and reduce delays for customers. In addition, Metro Bus will continue to retain investments in the priority corridor network and the Better Bus Initiative to address passenger standards and maintain on-time performance. The budget will also continue the collaboration with the human service agencies that board member Hans mentioned a little bit earlier to provide more effective service delivery options for Metro Access. More investment in new payment systems will give riders more options to securely and efficiently pay for their Metro ride. The new payment options, which are currently being piloted at key locations, will leverage current technology to make payment, or rather to make payment options more seamless for our customers. Initiatives around Metro's commitment to customer care, which is currently transforming Metro's culture into one that values customer satisfaction.
Is the slideshow stuck, or it has not been keeping up with you?
So initiatives around customer commitment to customer care, which is transforming Metro's culture into one that values customer satisfaction, will be maintained to ensure continued customer engagement on major transit issues. And building on current efforts to strengthen internal financial management, Building on current efforts to strengthen internal financial management and compliance, the FY16 budget will add resources to monitor adherence to applicable policies across the organization with the goal of improving financial management and reporting. The key safety initiatives for 2016 fiscal year will be fatigue risk management, as I mentioned earlier, which will be an expanded effort to protect passengers and employees through fatigue monitoring. By ensuring stable staffing for key positions within the organization, employee work schedules are already aligned with Metro's hours of service policy. However, with additional resources, this initiative will ensure that employees have the rest that they need to do their job safely. In terms of dollars and cents, Metro is projecting FY16 operating revenues of $933 million. This represents a budget-to-budget reduction of about 1.5% in terms of operating revenues, driven again by some of the conversations we had earlier, which relates to Metro Rail ridership and revenues. At the same time, the operating expense forecast for FY16 totals $1.61 billion, a 6% increase over the approved FY15 level. This figure reflects both mandatory as well as discretionary increases related to personnel as well as non-personnel services. But it also does contain some incremental initiatives. Taken together and after adjusting for preventive maintenance, this results in a preliminary subsidy requirement of $898 million. As noted earlier, we will be working between now and the GM's budget submission to identify efficiencies to bring down the operating expense and the associated subsidy requirements. Now, other than Metro safety and security initiatives, no single investment is more important to customer service than modernizing Metro's bus, rail, and assets fleet. The framework for this modernization is the Capital Improvement Program. The FY16 to 21 Capital Improvement Program presumes a new capital funding agreement that builds on the $75 million down payment from the Commonwealth of Virginia, the state of Maryland, and the District of Columbia in support of Metro 2025. The majority of the CIP, as you've come to expect, will focus on maintaining our system in a state of good repair, including major rehabilitations across the system, which also includes facilities as well as vehicle replacements. In addition, the CIP will support other key Metro 2025 projects, such as power upgrades and yard capacity expansion to support the ACAR train. It will also include core capacity improvements at Gallery Place and Union Station by 2020, then moving on to Lafont and Metro Center. There are elements with respect to bus fleet expansion, initial investment in next generation communications, as well as planning and engineering work on pocket tracks and blue line connection. Through 2021, the CIP is projected at $7 billion. This includes $5.3 billion for state of good repairs and about $1.7 billion for Metro 2025. The total investment between 2016 and 2021 will be familiar to you, because it's similar to what this committee saw last year. The difference is that there are slight adjustments on a project level basis with respect to timing, cost, and scope. What is truly new is 2021. The 2025 investments as a whole is that in 2021, there will be a substantial payment for the delivery of additional 7,000 series cars, as well as completion of the heavy rail facility and other smaller Metro 2025 initiatives. The state of grid repair category, however, will reflect the normal rehabilitation activities, although we also expect a milestone payment of around $70 million for the 8,000 series cars that will replace the current 2,000 and 3,000 series. But overall, the GM's upcoming budget proposal will continue to improve safety, service quality, and reliability to ensure that our customers will continue to have a better experience on Metro. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Yes, you.
Thank you for the presentation, and certainly this is early preliminary stage information, but suffice to say that there's no way that we're going to be able to absorb subsidy increases at 15% average, you know, I mean a rate level. That's just not going to happen. And then secondly, with reduction in ridership and revenues, 1% reduction overall in revenue budget, projected budget, and then yet there's an increase on the operating side. That's not going to happen. And, you know, so we have a lot of work cut out for us. And, you know, when you look at all the other things that localities are having to deal with not only the continued impact from sequestration, but the fact that, you know, we're, you know, statewide, our budgets are being further cut and reduced. And, I mean, I know my city, we're going to have to give local aid back to the state from their budget shortfalls and everything else. The realism that we can continue to ante up and give more to WMATA is just unrealistic. That's number one. Number two, in terms of the CIP, that's on the operating side. On the CIP side, initially the numbers look good, but you have to convince me and convince us in the local jurisdictions that, the need to ask for this additional money on the CIP side when we haven't shown and demonstrated our ability to spend what we already have. And so localities are going to be looking at this in terms of, you know, we have our own capital needs. Why should we be giving more to WMATA when they're not even spending it at the level that they should be? But yet they're asking for more. So I just want to get this on the table because we're in a very, very dire financial fight here, all of us, and so I just don't think folks should leave here thinking that, and again, this is early stages of the FY 2016 budget process, that all is, you know, we'll be able to work this out. Hopefully we will, but it's going to be a lot of pulling teeth to get there.
Yeah, I certainly would reflect Mr. Yule's comments as well. I think the confusing thing to me is the fact that we certainly, with the implementation and execution of the opening of the Silver Line, that you would expect more operating expenses and capital expenses, and the cost of operating the system is more. But I just don't understand why you're showing a reduction in revenues. At some point, I thought we were going to get more people on the system, thus more revenues. So I'm just a little concerned how you came up with those numbers. And then when I look at that's one series of questions. And when I look at the capital investment charts on page 66 of 69, which has the green color and the blue color, blue reflecting the 2025 projects and green reflecting the safety and good state and good repair. If you look at not 16 or beyond, but if you look at 15, forecast, you're only forecasting a little over $900 million, yet the budget call for $1.1 billion. So, I mean, you're already forecasting less expenditure than was in the budget. So there's a lot of little things like that that just jump out at me and express some concern about it.
Mr. Goldman.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Anasaki, for the report. I wanted to join with the mayor from the other side of the river in expressing some concern and trepidation about your preliminary forecast for FY16. If we could flash up, it's page 59 of 68, just to raise a couple points about that. Because at least I found the numbers I guess, very shocking. Page 59, it's headed multi-year operating budget, preliminary financial plan. I think what you're projecting there is for all the jurisdictions about $140 million gap in the subsidy difference between 15 and 16, which in a budget of operating budget of $1.9 billion should be something that staff can take a good hard look at and see if you can find a way to reduce that $140 million gap some way, either through some actions on your own or through some options that you can present to the board. Because I can tell you that for those of us who follow the election returns, there's some changes coming in Maryland in January. We can expect the new governor and the new legislature to be focused laser-like on reducing taxes and reducing expenses. And as the mayor indicated, WMATA is a good target out there to focus on. It's going to be a very hard sell to sell Maryland's increased share, which is 90 to 100 million probably, plus on top of that another 130 or 140 million in the capital improvement program that you showed. I think that's going to be a heavy lift. More staff can do to make our lift easier by reducing any projected increase in subsidy. I think we'd all find that a big help. Thank you.
Ms. Hutchins, and then Ms. Porter.
Thank you. Thank you for your presentation. And we all have our eyes of caution in front of us today. And I think maybe we should be thinking how to broaden our sights a little bit. And I think we really must be the voice for those who are going to listen to us as to what we really do expect out of this region. And I think it's very important that we really do articulate that. While I do agree that there's a sense of fear and a bit of discomfort, I think what we've done over the past several years has really shown that this is an investment. And it's an investment that if you want to be a job creator, you need to be at the table with us, because this is where you create these jobs for the region, and that is a proven fact. I do agree that it is difficult in terms of trying to look at the local budgets alone to think of who's going to increase their budgets to get to the level. And I'd just like to leave on the table the fact that we've been here before when we talked about the capital improvement program before, and we were able to get the federal government to the table as a partner. The federal government is also the largest user of this transit system in terms of who pays. And so we not only need to talk about the benefit program that the legislation has failed to include, but I really need, I think we need to talk to our legislators about the role that they, as agencies, need to play in an operating sense, because it is not only to the benefit of the localities that this plays. This plays to the entire region, and the largest beneficiary is the federal government. So while there are some bad signs in front of us, I think we need to think about how we want to approach our discussion about this issue. Otherwise, we will be back to where we were. And I think where we have been is not an acceptable one for a region that needs a driving economy. So I don't disagree with the opinion in terms of the dollars and cents, but I do think that we should be extremely cautious as to what we are going to be willing to accept as a region if we think the only way we will solve the problems that face us today is that we will disinvest. I think we better help people understand why they need to invest. And believe me, it is an investment, and it's an investment that's a return. So I really do think we need to broaden our discussion. We need to get more people at this table to understand what the budget looks like. And we also need to continue to look at our budget and see where in this budget that we need to focus in order to remain in an investment posture. Some things we may not be able to do, but they may be extended into a larger part of our budget.
Ms. Porter.
Although I'm loath to disagree with Mr. Giancola, I want to say that I was not pleased, but heartened to see that we are estimating a reduction in ridership this coming year. I think in hindsight, our estimates for the current year were overly optimistic. And I think what we're doing in this particular proposal, this proposed budget, is more realistic. And we can put whatever we want in a budget, but if ridership is down, ridership is down, and that's just going to leave us with holes. So I think I'm unhappy to see ridership down, but I think it's actually a more realistic estimate, and I would not encourage us to make any changes in that.
Mr. Downs.
I used to have a saying that the facts won't set you free, but they're sometimes helpful. And in this case, while the macro numbers pose a significant problem for all of us about telling the story, it's really important about understanding what is behind the numbers, because without understanding those numbers, you can't tell a story. For instance, bus revenues are forecasted to continue an upward climb. So bus is taking care of itself. Our revenue problems are in rail, and with a forecasted decline in rail revenue of almost $20 million next year, we're doing that in the face of having opened a new rail segment. And that would indicate that there are potentially longer term cyclical changes taking place in how rail is utilized in this region. And part of it may be the transit benefit, part of it may be telecommuting. The answer to Mike's earlier question indicate, we simply do not know enough to be able to forecast this and develop a plan around what we would do about that and what it means both in the intermediate term and the long term for the rail system. And I think we have to have that as a next step about explaining what these numbers mean. On the expense side, on 59 of 69, we have a breakout on passenger fares and non-passenger revenue, et cetera. But on 60, we have operating revenues, operating expenses, gross operating subsidy, et cetera, without a more complete breakout of where the expense trends are coming from and where they are going longer term, so that understanding the expense drivers is really important to be able to craft a story here. There are hard choices coming, of course, but part of that has to be in the context of having better information, not only for the board, but for the public and all of our stakeholders about what is actually driving our expenses by dollar amount and how you forecast that beyond 16 and what that means about what might have to be sacrificed in the budget. We need to start that conversation sooner rather than later. It's hard to believe that we're thinking about Christmas, which means 15 is just around the corner, and this debate is going to overwhelm us if we're not careful and timely, both from a political standpoint about all of the changes in the politics of the region, but also our own calendar will begin to work against us if we're not doing a lot better about detailed information and analysis, thoughtful analysis that can be transmitted back to our stakeholders and to our customers.
Thanks, Mr. Downey. I agree with a lot of what Tom said about the context that we're in and the need, I think, to approach what we need to do in 16 from at a different level of board understanding than perhaps we've been before. These stories have antecedents, and part of what I think we do need to be collectively more clear on is the ways in which you have gone into the existing budget and reorganized and revamped and put savings on the table over the last several years is indeed a part of the story. And I don't, you know, you have to kind of cast back in your memory, and if you weren't here, it's hard to do, and even if you were here, it's hard to do. But budgets are about choices, and they are about priorities. And it would, I think, be a mistake for us to not be clear with the public as soon as possible what the choices are. What does trying to hold the line at the numbers we have today mean in terms of service, in terms of training, in terms of fatigue management, all things which are important, I think, to the region. And this is not to set people off, but for people to understand. You know, as we've watched the bus ridership climb, I know that when I talk to younger people in Arlington, there is, especially those who are income constrained, they're making a bus choice now instead of the train choice. And we should all remember the bus, we're subsidizing 75 to 80% of the cost of that ride. And on the train, we're subsidizing 20 or 25% of the cost of the ride. So there is this place where perhaps, as counterintuitive as it sounds, we ought to be thinking about lowering rail fare. And would that, in fact, get us more riders? And would that, in fact, help us in our budget problem? Because it would put it back into what some of these folks can afford. And I know it sounds nuts to even say that as we're looking at these numbers, but we have to, and I don't know in this setting how we put those things on the table. Last year, Marcel and I talked about should we have some budget workshops for the board and our staff together to sort of pose questions and dig into some of this. And it didn't appear that we needed to do that last year. But I really think maybe we do. Maybe this year we really need to sit around and understand the relationships here better in terms of how the money comes, but also understand, as Tom said, what the drivers are, which drivers we have any effect on, and what those choices are that the region needs to consider. If we really, and my budget isn't any better than Bill's. Let me just say that, it's not. And we're already really struggling to figure out how we would manage our percent of this number. And, but I just, I'm with Kathy on the sense of, you know, this is a vital piece of our region's success. And we have a unique responsibility to clarify the choices for the region moving forward and not just slip slide into not doing maintenance because we can't afford it or slip slide into some other thing, which as a long-term practice is not a good thing for us all. So I really, Mr. Chairman, I think we need to think through how we have some different conversations for the board.
Mary, great idea. With new mayor in District of Columbia, I think we need to have a budget workshop or two because, as Tom points out, we got new players, I don't know, Michael in Maryland, et cetera, but I would second that idea, Mary. Thank you.
There are facts, as Tom said, about what expenses have to be met. There are facts about our ridership. One, I would correct, it is not actually a decline in ridership in 16 from 15. It's a decline from the 15 budget, but Had it grown the way we would like, we'd be in much less of a problem. But I think we need to work out a process, as Mary suggests, to get a budget proposal from the CEO that we can look at, disaggregate, understand, and understand the consequences of decisions. We're going to have to make decisions. The bottom line will have to be something that balances with what a reasonable expectation is from the jurisdictions. And this will mean choices. It will mean choices. If we make the choice that there will not be a fare increase, and that's an appropriate choice based on our ongoing policy, then there will be other choices we have to make. And to the extent we make them, we have to be very clear what the consequences are and what the things are that would do the least harm by doing it. We've had a couple of very good years. We've had a lot of efficiencies that have been put into the system, but we're going to have to go back and relook at everything to see where we are. Putting my federal hat on, I do have to say any expectation that the federal government will come along with operating assistance to support this system is minimal to nil. That was history. That went away 20 years ago and is never coming back. We do have the opportunity in the coming year, I hope, to make our appropriate pitch to the federal government for increase in capital support, either probably through the general program. It's not the time to be relooking at the special program. But we have support on the Hill. We have support at the White House. But it won't be for saving the fare or paying the operating costs. It will be for doing what really needs to be done in rebuilding the system. Reaction?
Thank
You've
you,
heard
Mr.
from
Chairman.
Everybody?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
No surprises?
No, not really. I do want to say that I appreciate all the comments with respect to the preceding discussions. And we understand the concern out there with respect to resource constraints, as well as the need for continued investment in the system. The challenge which the general manager has directed us to undertake is to identify appropriate areas where we can come up with alternative recommendations for him going forward. And we are going to be doing that diligently to hopefully provide him and ultimately this board with some options. As most of you have said this morning, those options have policies embedded in them and ultimately will require decisions as to make sure that we have a balanced budget for 2016.
I meant to make the comment earlier, but I want to recognize the fact that the general manager and the staff has consistently been moderate to conservative in their budgeting over the past 4 or 5 years. That has given us reserves for unexpected issues that arose within a budget year. We've been able to manage to a relatively well-balanced budget at the end of a year, and that gives me optimism about the general manager's budget going forward.
In other words, all miracles are gracefully accepted. Yeah. No pressure here. Anything else for the good of the order? Would you put the last slide up again, just in terms of our all of our understanding of the schedule? We will see the budget proposal in December. As currently outlined, we will have January and February to work on it. We should talk about the best format to do that. And the adoption in March is what we have achieved in prior years. I'm not saying we should sacrifice quality for timeliness, but that should be a goal, to get it done in time to be effectively implemented, especially if there are some tough choices that have to be made as part of that implementation.
Mr. Chairman, I would just suggest that perhaps staff might want to poll the jurisdictions on their budget completion dates,
yes,
as well as make sure that they have General Assembly dates from both of our states, because in fact there may be stuff in play that we can't imagine, and
right,
and March may be aggressive given what's going on in the jurisdictions.
Okay, meeting adjourned.